Hello and welcome to Playback. Una Kelly here, standing in for Sinead Mooney.
But if you are wondering what that is, you can hear in the background. It's Danny Healy-Ray and supporters outside Leinster House a short time ago.
The TDs were back in town. Wednesday's News at One was broadcast from near Leinster House as the 34th Dáil held its first sitting. But not everyone was in the mood for celebrations.
In fact, I'd rather walk on a bed of coals than have to deal with this situation.
On Tuesday, Fianna Fáil TD and outgoing Cathain Comhairle, Sean O'Farrill, spoke to Clare ahead of the election of the new Cathain Comhairle.
Your party leader wants Fianna Fáil TDs to vote for independent TD Verona Murphy to be Cathain Comhairle, but you still want the job.
Well, I would happily withdraw, but for the fact that if I don't defend the principle of the primacy of the Dáil and the right of the members to elect in an unfettered way whomsoever they please, and if I don't stand up against this bartering for position which is going on, well then who will? Because I've dedicated two terms in office to reform, and the principles of that reform are important to me, and I don't want to see any of them rolled back upon.
But it is a secret vote, isn't it? I mean, Micheál Martin can say what he wants to the Fianna Fáil TDs. They will ultimately have to decide who to vote for.
Well, they will, but I would never underestimate the influence of the leader of Fianna Fáil or the leader of Fine Gael or the leader of any political party. Leaders carry real weight. Again, I come back to the point, I fully accept the need to form a stable, lasting government as quickly as possible. The country is crying out for that. But these are not posts to be bartered with as part of that process.
By Wednesday's News at One, Verona Murphy looked set to be the winner. Rachel spoke to Paul Cunningham.
Are there many disgruntled TDs in Fianna Fáil and indeed in Fine Gael over the fact that they have been told to vote for Verona Murphy?
I think to a degree there's a concern, but I wouldn't want to overstate it either. This was a secret ballot. It was possible for those Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil TDs to listen to the instructions of Micheál Martin and Simon Harris and say, do you know what? I'm going to go a different way. But on those numbers, it looks as if they've gone ahead and done what they said or were asked to do. But nonetheless, there is this sense that the person who is the Cathain Comhairle or the Speaker of the Dáil, that they are an independent voice, that they represent all members, not just what the government says. And I think to a certain extent, people were miffed at it. But ultimately, this is about government formation. This was seen as part of the deal. And that seems to have resonated with most of those prospective coalition members.
We have a clip of Verona Murphy. Now, it's from last week when she was speaking to her local radio station, that's South East Radio, about the job of Cathain Comhairle and about whether she was interested in it. Let's give a listen.
When you are the Cathain Comhairle,
right,
you have access to every minister.
And have you got full government minister rights? Are you a full government minister if you're Cathain Comhairle? I'm just looking from the point
of
view.
It's the equivalent, yes. It is the equivalent.
Okay.
But look, it's speculation that I am honoured that my group they will put me forward should I choose to take that position. But I will be convening a meeting of my supporters and I'll take stock from what they have to say about that. I have no doubt I'm certainly in a better position as Cathain Comhairle to influence and deliver for Wexford than I would be as a TD in opposition. However, the opposition that I have come from.
And that was Verona Murphy speaking a week ago to Alan Corcoran on South East Radio. It's an interesting one, Paul, isn't it?
That's a great word, Rachel English, an interesting one.
A diplomatic word. How much power does the Cathain Comhairle actually have and what do they actually do?
With regard to the capacity of a Cathain Comhairle to go into a minister's office and say, I want a road from X to Y, that isn't something we're very much aware of. But no doubt it'll be something we'll be following up with the deputy. And to what extent is any decision made in her county down to her lobbying?
By Wednesday's drive time, Verona Murphy had made history. The first woman elected as Cathain Comhairle. She assumed the Speaker's chair.
I am humbled, honoured and privileged to serve as Crown Corla of this great state. And I undertake to be fair and impartial, to be even-handed and even-tempered in the chair. To the general public, I hope to be a reforming Crown Corla like my predecessor and make the operations of the House more relevant in terms of the way it affects you day to day. I take on board the comments today and I undertake to improve my Irish to a level that is commensurate with the office I now hold.
Picking apart the day's events on Drive Time, Sarah spoke to Minister for Sport Thomas Byrne and Sinn Féin TD Claire Curran.
We have heard now since the election from both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that none of this is about positions, that it's all about policies and getting the right policies. And the first thing we see, though, isn't it, is about a position. It's about a position that is being, that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael told their parties to vote for Fiona Murphy for the position of Ciarán Corla so that you can make a deal with regional independence.
Well, the first thing that the Dáil has to do when it convenes, and the first thing any parliament does when it convenes anywhere in the world, is elect a chairperson, Ciarán Corla. And that's exactly what happened today. Our party made a call on that. Other parties made different calls on that. And Fiona Murphy was elected, was selected to be the candidate that was put before the Dáil.
Why was she selected to be the candidate? Why did Micheál Martin tell Fianna Fáil TDs to vote for Fiona Murphy?
Micheál Martin didn't tell Fianna Fáil TDs to do anything. It was a secret ballot. The party comes together to make a decision. And the party came together and agreed with the recommendation of the leader after a very good discussion yesterday.
Okay, so he didn't tell you he recommended that you vote for Fiona Murphy. Why? Because there was two Fianna Fáil TDs who were interested in the position. So why did he recommend voting for someone who's not in the party? Can you explain that to me if it's
because,
not a party?
Because as I said, we need to have more than just Fianna Fáil in government. We need to have Fine Gael and others as well to make sure that we can implement the policies that we've there. And there have been discussions with the independent group, and as part of those discussions, there's no agreement yet. It was proposed that Fiona Murphy would be the candidate for Ciarán Corla.
Claire Curran, Ingus Snuddy put himself forward. He seemed confident enough earlier on, but it wasn't his day.
No, it wasn't. But Angus got actually a really good vote, and fair play to him, and fair play to him for allowing his name to go forward. I was looking at Sean O'Friel in the chamber as Micheál Martin stood up and spoke lots of nice words about him. I found the whole thing really bizarre. I mean, there hasn't been a reason given as to why Fiona Murphy was suggested to be the person that both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TD should support today. I found the whole thing very bizarre. I mean, Fianna Fáil had two of their own people, their own colleagues, friends, in a lot of cases, I would imagine, putting their names forward, neither of which the party suggested supporting. I found the whole thing quite bizarre,
Well, is it bizarre, though? Because, I mean, Thomas Byrne has laid out there, they're trying to put a government together. They're in negotiations with the Regional Independent Group. The Regional Independent Group put forward Ronan Murphy's name as someone that they'd like to see in the Ciarán Corla position, and politics happened.
And we'll leave the politics there. Turning to Liveline now, caller Pauline Gaffney appealed to listeners to help her locate the owner of a parrot she's been temporarily looking after.
Now, when I took him in, which is almost 2 weeks ago,
yes,
they thought he was feral. He was quite wild. He'd never been handled. Now, I do have other birds, so I would be used to handling these parrots. And he is not wild. He is very, very tame. And I think that maybe somebody has put years and years of effort into this bird.
And what's his name?
Well, we call him Ozzy at the moment.
Ozzy, okay. What sound does he make, Ozzy?
He's quiet. He just whistles.
Okay, whistles. Okay.
He doesn't talk. He doesn't seem to talk.
Well, do your other parrots talk?
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And what do they do?
I'm just hoping now they don't start talking when you're on the phone here, because they can be quite inappropriate at times. And the African greys do talk a lot.
Do they? And what do you mean inappropriate?
Oh, well, their language can be colourful at times.
Go away, choice.
No choice words on Liveline, please. Later in the week, Joe and guests, including Sinead O'Carroll, went through the highs and lows of the year. Can you guess what one of the biggest lows was?
Like, is there any other country in the world where I just say the bike shelter and everyone in the country knows what you're talking about?
Before Air Joe asked us, how much is the bike shelter? And all at once we went, €336,000 burned into our brains.
And that's the thing about
the bike shelter. You know, you have things that cost astronomical amounts and people don't bat an eyelid. But when something tells the story of how a state spends its money, it really captures the imagination. Yeah. So, you know, I think when people started hearing about it, they wanted to see the bike shed.
Yeah.
What bells and whistles are on this bike shed? Like, does it have an underground tunnel?
And it's very underwhelming, actually, when you see it.
Yeah.
And over to one of the highs, the Irish Olympians. Boxer Kelly Harrington may not have been in studio, but Jo was keen to make her presence felt.
Kelly, is Kelly Harrington? Kelly, give us a bar of grace there. Are you ready, Kelly? Come on, Kelly. This is one of the highlights. It's been a great programme for sports people singing, isn't it? The singing jockey and the singing boxer.
Drama on One presented the first episode of its new series, The Burning Question. Here, presenter Louise Williams discusses how nature has rights in different countries.
Law, which is the backbone of how we relate to each other, struggles to find a basis for the rights of nature. And the earth can't give instructions to its lawyer. In Ecuador, nature and its survival are at the heart of the country's constitution. The state in Ecuador can prosecute human actions that put species and ecosystems at risk. In New Zealand, the Whanganui River is the first river in the world that has legal personhood, which means that the river's needs can be at the heart of a prosecution. The river has rights. It can have standing, locus standi, in a court of law. That may put the river's needs ahead of human needs. It's a paradigm shift to prosecute on behalf of the planet rather than on behalf of one of its human inhabitants. If we acknowledge that the living planet is suffering, can we conceive of its protection as our duty of care?
And later in the programme, author and barrister Philippe Sands talked about how fossil fuel companies could theoretically be held accountable if a new international crime of ecocide is adopted.
You can't put a corporation in prison. All you can do is impose a fine on a corporation, they pay the fine, and they just carry on. I think nothing concentrates the mind more than the fear of a tap on the shoulder and the possibility that you may end up doing time. You focus on the chief executive officers, the chief operating officers, the chief financial officers, maybe the largest shareholders, and you focus on those individuals. You don't need to focus on the corporations. It's very obvious that fossil fuels is at the heart of climate change, and if climate change is going to be part of the ecocide framework, then those individual executives who take a decision to engage in a particular activity, in my view, ought to know that they are at risk of criminal investigation. Equally, those politicians who grant licenses. One aspect that I thought was just outrageous, the United Kingdom authorising a new coal mine, the United Kingdom giving out hundreds of licenses just in, you know, very recent period for new oil exploitation in the North Sea. To my mind, the politicians who decided on those things should know or should have been instructed that they are at risk of individual criminal liability for engaging in those kinds of acts. It's as simple as that. That really concentrates the mind.
Turning to more festive thoughts, on Sunday Miscellany, Jim Maguire recalled the run-up to Christmas 1984, when he brought his 88-year-old grandmother to Dublin Airport for the very first time to have her tea. And in the restaurant, they found themselves sitting beside some pop superstars.
When I was about 2 or 3 yards away, I realised in shock and amazement that Nana was sitting beside George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley from Wham. One of the biggest pop bands in the world at the time. They just played 2 nights in the RDS. At that stage, I was hoping that the ground would open up and swallow me, but I had to continue. When I got to the table, I said to my Nana in a quiet voice, come on, Nana, we'll find another seat. Immediately, George Michael said, no, sit down. This is the most interesting lady we've ever spoken to. So I sat down and the table of four was complete. With me, Nana, George Michael and Andrew Ridgely. We proceeded to have our tea, this unlikely foursome. The two pop stars were warm and friendly, and the four of us chatted away naturally. I remember that they were fascinated with the fact that my Nana had been born in the 1800s, the last century. They appeared to be really interested in what she had to say. Then everything went quiet. My Nana leaned forward to me and she said in quite a loud voice, Jim, these boys have earrings. Once again, I was hoping for a hole in the ground to open up. But the two pop stars laughed and laughed and were genuinely enthralled with my Nana. After we all finished our tea, maybe half an hour later, we said our farewells and left. Every time I hear Wham's Last Christmas on the radio, I think of that December day back in 1984 when my Nana visited Dublin Airport for the first time and had her tea of pork chops, peas, chips, tea, bread and butter in the company of two absolute gentlemen, Andrew Ridgely and the late George Michael.
Now, from 80s hits to modern standouts, Louise Duffy gave Claire a rundown of her favourite songs of 2024.
This is the most miserable song on the list. It's shocking. It's like, you know, sometimes you need a song if you just want to have a cry.
Ah, yeah.
Put this on your list then. It's kind of sad and scary. It's got that kind of grit of Fairy Tale of New York. It's like the love story went a little bit haywire on the two of them. But the beautiful voices of Iron and Wine, he's Sam Beam, and you could spend days engrossed in his music, and Fiona Apple. The two of them sound, they didn't come together. This was done remotely. It just sounds perfect though. But all in good time. Yeah, it's just, I love it. It's one of those ones that will drive you to distraction in that if you listen to it, you'll find yourself humming it days later. Well, I do anyway, to the point of annoyance.
Let's hear it.
All in good time, I gave it my best. It's a lovely duet. I love a good duet.
See, this is why we wanted you here, because yes, you're going to bring us these things that we might have missed.
Yeah, I'll put it together in a playlist and you can spend your time. He came to see me, you know, we had a session with him. He lives in the mountains in Colorado or somewhere with five daughters. There's a movie, he had a concert film out as well this year, and he's just a really interesting artist.
This is Sam Beam,
Iron and Wine. Yeah,
right. And he said of her voice is a miracle that sounds like both a sacrifice and a weapon at the same time.
That's something, isn't it? That's the way for colleagues to talk about each other, isn't it? That's the review you want.
Colleagues Louise Duffy and Claire Byrne on Louise's Songs of the Year. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Well, weeks later, the fallout from Storm Dara is still being felt, blowing travel plans off course for those hoping to get ferries from the damaged Holyhead port. As people scramble to make new arrangements, on Tuesday, Claire spoke to Ken Skates, the Welsh Secretary for Transport.
I would say that it's absolutely vital at this time of year that that aeroplane operators show empathy to people who are needing to get back to Ireland for Christmas, and it's not helpful when fares rise astronomically. So I'd appeal to those airlines not to increase fares given the severity of the situation.
So that's a direct appeal to the likes of Ryanair and to Aer Lingus not to increase their prices.
I think it'd be very helpful if they could be part of the solution in the most sympathetic and empathetic way.
And with some reports of rising airfares, Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary was there to have his say.
You heard the man there, Ken Skates. He's asking you to act with empathy and not to increase prices astronomically. What do you say?
I'd say far too late. Prices have already increased astronomically, but it has almost nothing to do with the closure of Holyhead. Prices have increased astronomically this Christmas because there's 220,000 less seats at Dublin Airport. because we couldn't get slots for those flights.
Yeah, and I saw your statement.
Entirely due to the Dublin Airport cap.
Okay, and now
nothing to do with Holyhead.
I saw your statement on this, and you're saying that the reason the prices are higher because of the cap. But James Lawless had a look at the statement as well. He checked on Friday, and he said there were 4,000 additional spaces on flights on Friday, and he said sell those seats and then come back and talk to us about the cap.
I mean, I don't even know what that means. What does 4,000 spaces mean? Like, you know, it's a meaningless number. We have less than 4,000 flights, but more than 40,000 seats. So,
well, he's talking about seats on planes, isn't he?
Well, no, then the number's completely wrong, because we have 40,000 seats still to sell between the UK, Dublin, Belfast, Cork for the next week. So what James Lawless said was just rubbish.
Let's leave the politics aside for a second. Like, the call here is for you to be
challenging,
but just be decent about the prices and keep it affordable. You're talking about people getting
home
for Christmas.
There is no one more decent about prices than Ryanair. But here's the reality: we allow the passengers to set the fares. The last five fares, the last five seats on every plane, will be sold at the highest fares. Already, and we warned about this 6 months ago, already on Friday the 20th and on the 24th, our fares one way from London to Dublin are at £500. It's nothing to do with Holyhead. It's entirely to do with a gross shortage of seats in and out of Dublin this Christmas because of the Dublin Airport cap.
The demand has gone up in the last couple of days because of Holyhead. You'd accept that point, I'm sure.
I wouldn't, actually.
Well, you're not seeing more bookings as a result of what happened with Storm Dara?
Nope.
There's been no additional demand on places from the UK to Ireland after Holyhead was completely knocked out of action?
Nope.
Right.
By evening, it was official. Holyhead Port will stay closed until mid-January. On Drive Time, Cormac discussed this with Minister of State for Transport, James Lawless.
It's really difficult on customers, isn't it? On passengers trying to forget about freight for a second, but people trying to get home. Michael O'Leary saying today that the big increase in fares between Ireland and Britain has nothing to do, he says, with the closure of Holyhead Port in Wales.
And yet he makes his way into the airwaves to bleat on about it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary how some people take every crisis and turn it into an opportunity for themselves.
Well,
Michael O'Leary never misses an opportunity to walk past a microphone. But I looked.
I'm sure he was invited on. What about his substantive point? I mean, is that a fair thing to say? I suppose it is, based on his business model. He outlined that for Claire Byrne this morning. Do you believe that there's no connection between what's happening in Holyhead and the increase in fares?
Well, he is an expert in aviation. He says there isn't. But what's more important, he's suggesting that fares are increasing. Now, I went onto skyscanner.ie. I know Michael doesn't like that website, but it is an option for people that want to book. I went onto that 30 minutes ago. Their fares are ranging from €180, €215, €185, €216 for a range of dates between the 19th of December, 20th of December, 21st of December, right up to Christmas Eve, and come back over the Christmas period. So the facts actually would appear not to back up Michael's argument.
I don't know, because he was quite adamant, wasn't he, Minister? He said actually that thousands of people who should be travelling to Dublin Airport because of the passenger cap are having to travel to Ireland via Belfast. And he said that shouldn't be. He said that the Minister of the Day and you, as Minister of State, should write a letter and increase the passenger cap and there would be no problem.
Well, look, sorry, that's a gross oversimplification. And I'm not even going to treat that with any seriousness because we've been through that already.
And amid all the rows, spare a thought for those stranded passengers. Audrey Eager had booked a ferry ticket from Holyhead to Dublin. On Thursday, she told Claire about her change in Christmas travel plans.
As soon as that announcement came out on Tuesday, I had to look at the flight option. So I'm now flying back tonight.
And how much did the flight cost you?
€300 one way.
One way. And have you booked your return?
Not yet, because sometimes I would always decide if I want to come back by ferry, which is now not an option, but I will have to come back by plane now this time around.
Yeah, and it's not your choice. I know that every year when you come home, you go on the ferry, don't you? That's your thing.
It is my thing. People think I'm mad. I love the whole, you know, the bit of the Chris Rea driving home for Christmas mood. The atmosphere is always very good on the ferry, and it's just something I really enjoy doing every year.
Mm-hmm. So your sail and rail ticket was how much?
£60.
And you got that back, or you will get it back, will you?
Yes. No, I have received that back already.
So £60 sterling was your original price. That was for your return trip, was it?
No, that was one way.
That was one way. But now you've had to pay €300 for your one-way ticket home.
Yeah, yeah.
And probably, have you had a look at the prices coming back? It's probably around the same, is it?
I don't want yet. There's only one shot to the system.
Well, listen,
I could take it a week.
It's great news that you are getting back, Audrey. I know it's been difficult and you've had a stressful week, but at least you're getting home, you know?
That's it.
Isn't that the main thing?
It is, it is. And I'm being able now to come back with hopefully most of the presents that Santa has wanted me to bring as well. So I'm not going to disappoint anybody.
And Audrey is just one of thousands flying home to Dublin Airport. On Friday, Áine Lawler spoke to reporter Maggie Doyle in the arrivals hall. Someone get some tissues out.
Oh, I was nearly crying typing up the intro to this earlier on, Maggie. It's just such a special time of year at the airport.
It's incredibly special, Áine, and I know most people listening have probably seen that particular Christmas movie, but I can tell you it has actually got nothing on Dublin Airport this morning and all of the lovely feelings and emotions that are running around here. I mean, there's Christmas trees, there's twinkling lights going up and down the escalators, there's beautiful festive decorations in the arrivals hall. I'm here in Terminal 2 this morning. And there's been loads of family members here to welcome people home. Loads of mammies, some homemade signs. We're expecting to see lots of them throughout the day. The first flight to arrive here this morning was an early one from Abu Dhabi. So lots of people coming via there from across Asia and Australia. And lots of people very keen to talk to me about the people that they're meeting off that flight this morning. You'll hear some of them now. And the first person I spoke to was Michelle, who had just arrived from Melbourne with the whole family, and her sister Tina was there to meet her.
I'm Michelle, husband Paul, four kids. We live in Australia, in Melbourne, Australia, and this is our first time home for Christmas in 18 years as a family.
And is it lovely to have the nice welcome?
Yeah, it is, it's lovely, yes.
We're waiting for our daughter. She's coming from Manila. Her name is Ava.
And you've got a lovely sign here. What does it say?
Welcome home on one side and let the party begin. She's a lively lady.
A lively lady. And how long is it since she's been home?
Last Christmas.
My name is Coco. We're coming back from Kuala Lumpur to see our granddad. It's been a long flight. We live in Kuala Lumpur.
So are you going to Nice from the airport now?
Yeah.
So my name is Nicola Shields and I'm waiting for my father and old Rowan to come back from Thailand with his beautiful girlfriend Lek, and he's coming home because his father on the ride.
And how long is it since you've seen your dad?
I was really lucky because I got to have him home at Christmas. Like, my dad's 83 and every time he gets back it's a privilege because he's living in Thailand for 19 years now.
Well, welcome home. Your daughter was delighted to see you.
Oh, thank you. I hope the rest of the family is delighted.
That was a long old flight, Noel. How are you feeling?
Long. Very tired. Yeah. 14 hours is a long flight. Yeah.
Brandon's bread rating, he'll be fine.
anyway, I'm here to marry my daughter, if you like, you know. It's sentimental now, yeah. But great surprise, you yeah. And a happy Christmas to everyone out there.
Well, fair play to that 83-year-old daddy, Maggie. Some lovely scenes there. What are DAA saying? I mean, apart from all the tissues, are they set up for these 93,000 passengers?
They absolutely are. Áine, I just want to talk to you, though, about that family reunion. The first person we heard there was Michelle, who had just landed from Melbourne. And get this. So she landed from Melbourne with her four teenage and young adult children, whose first Christmas in Dublin will be this year. Waiting for them was her sister Tina, but also then the new American boyfriend of one of those young adult children. They met while they were on an Erasmus last year. His name is William. He's from North Carolina. He was here with two bunches of flowers for the girlfriend he hadn't seen in 6 months and for the mammy who he was meeting for the very first time. I mean, it was
he's
going
a keeper.
On.
He's definitely a keeper.
He absolutely is a keeper.
Up with flowers.
From Morning Ireland. Now, with all those visitors coming, journalist Claire Ronan spoke to Cormac and Sarah about setting some house rules.
Now, look, I also think to give them an agenda of what sort of things happen if they haven't stayed with you before. Like Mary likes to go to 8 o'clock mass. Brian likes to climb Ben Bulb and somebody else plays PlayStation games. This is the type of Christmas we have. Mm. You can either join in or stay in your room, whatever way you want it. And then the menu as well. This is what we eat. If you want something else, you can cook
my
it.
God.
Or you can cook it, whatever.
Okay. Oh, okay. Lord. That sounds good to me.
What time is the theme song?
Can we discuss the vulgar topic of money, because this comes up every year. So do you charge your guests or not?
Are you gone mad, are you?
I've never even heard of that.
Guys, it costs a fortune. So, okay, you don't want to talk about the vulgar topic of money, but you want somebody to bring the wine. Don't bring one bottle. Get over yourself. Bring more. Bring cheese. Bring puddings. Yeah. Bring cakes. And if you're travelling from abroad, to land yourself on top of your poor family for 3 or 4 days and you can't pick anything up, yeah, offer cold hard cash. It costs a fortune.
Well, Sarah, we're definitely not going to Claire Ronan's house. Claire.
From Drive Time. On Wednesday on Ray D'Arcy, singers Jerry Fish and Tosheen joined the RTE Concert Orchestra for this festive classic. Gorgeous. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, in a few days, Santa sets off from the North Pole to visit children across the world. And as UCD physicist Dr. Shane Bergen explained, there's some serious science behind it.
And he comes down the chimney at incredible speeds, and he's able to come into your house, deliver the presents under the tree and get out, all within about a thousandth of a second. But he's moving so fast that Santa Claus would actually start to stretch, right? He would be kind of in the area of physics that Albert Einstein described. So he would actually be starting to stretch and spaghettify, right? So he would be the perfect shape to come down the chimney because the chimney is long and narrow. So he'd come down that very, very quickly. But he can equally, he can slide under the door and he could even probably come in through the keyhole if he needed to.
Yeah, and vents and things like that. So
oh, yeah,
a thousandth of a second, is that all he has really?
Yeah, when you think about it, Santa Claus has to visit around, I reckon, 400 million children. On a Christmas Eve. And he has, because of the way time zones work, if he moves east to west, he has 31 hours to do his job. Mm-hmm. So he has to move at really, really fast speeds. You know, Aaron O'Dearn were on there earlier on. They might want to take a leaf out of Santa Claus's book as to how you can get from A to B in record time. He'd be moving, we reckon, at around 10,000 times the speed of a jumbo jet airplane.
Now, how does he know where all the children are? Because we mentioned that you might be in your own house, but even apart from that, how does Santa know where all the children live?
Yeah, and how does he manage things like GDPR, right, in terms of data protection? I reckon Santa Claus has the most advanced database in the world, right? He probably has what we would call in science a supercomputer. So the computers that we all use on our phones or at home, they have memory in them and it can be slow to access things and to pull up files, etc. But I reckon Santa Claus has something like a quantum computer. And I reckon that Santa Claus, because he lives in the North Pole where it's really cold, those computers rely on coldness for them to work actually in the real world. So I reckon Santa Claus has probably been way ahead of us with the technology and has
a
supercomputer. So he knows, and it's patched into the GPS that he'd have on his sleigh. When he's over Europe, he would use our satellite systems like the Galileo satellite that Europe uses for GPS. He'd also be tapping into the Copernicus satellite system to understand the weather systems. And he'd even be looking at the solar weather, because Santa Claus would have to fly so high in the sky. He'd be above the regular weather. He'd be interested in the effects of what the sun is doing at any time.
Let's talk about the sleigh then. So many Christmas movies are based around how does Santa's sleigh fly? But what's the science? What do we know?
But I reckon from a science point of view, well, it's pulled by reindeer. Given they all have antlers, that would mean that they're female reindeer, right? Because the males lose their antlers so at that time of year. So all of the 8 reindeer would be female, right? And they're magical reindeer. They'd have big antlers and they would be moving at such speeds that I reckon that the antlers act like wings on an airplane. So they would cause lift. So they would allow the sleigh to take off. how many presents are there? 200 million, or sorry, 400 million children, and say if each get two presents each, which would be very reasonable, that would, I reckon, mean a sleigh that would have the volume of 20 times the volume of Croke Park. Now, I don't mean the seats, I mean the whole bowl of Croke Park filled 20 times. That's mm-hmm. how many presents he'd have to be pulling in the sleigh to give two to each child.
But so, again, magic.
Yeah, I don't know how he does it. Yeah. So he might use something like nanoscience. We don't know mm-hmm. how he would fit them into the sleigh. We genuinely don't know. But the scientists can start to imagine what he might do. But we don't know for sure.
It's a mystery. Dr. Shane Bergen on the science behind Santa. Earlier this year, we lost the highly esteemed Irish writer, Edna O'Brien. On Bowman on Sunday, John trawled the RTE sound archives to reflect on her life. In a public interview with Miles Dungan in Dublin, Edna O'Brien described how she quickly wrote her first novel, The Country Girls, after being given a £50 advance from a publisher.
I spent it rapidly. I bought my children some, drums and toys and things. I bought a sewing machine to give my husband the belief, which of course wasn't the case, that I was a good housewife. And I am a good housewife. I can cook. I swear I can cook. My sister and my nephew would vouch for it, and my niece. Anyhow, I spent that £50, it went. And we had moved to England to a very secluded, not to say grand, but out-of-the-way place where you had to take a bus to get a bus. And I had spent the famous £50 and now had the thing write a book. And I wrote it. My little children went to a little kindergarten school, and I would bring them in the morning and then come back and sit in their bedroom. And The Country Girls, as I have often said, would that it were to happen again, wrote itself. I just sat down, I wakened quickly, and what was so interesting, it has a bit of comedy, The Country Girls. I mean, that you will concede. And when it was finished in minutes, but while I was writing it, well, in minutes, in 3 weeks, while I was writing it, at the end of the day when I would get up, I was full of tears. I hadn't known how much I wanted to get away from family, country. Every young person wants to get away because you imagine you're going to go to, first of all, you imagine you're going to become a different person, and you imagine you're going into freedom, exoticness, love, you name it. Well, that doesn't happen. But the Ireland I had wanted and family and everything, I felt very, which is probably true. I could not have written it in County Clare. No, I couldn't. And that's neither an attack or a compliment. It's just a fact. So it was written, it was accepted, I think, in about 20 countries, and I was a bit happy. Well, that didn't last long, because I get a letter from the head nun. She was called Sister Teresa in the convent, Loch Ray. And I knew her handwriting, shivering. And she says, we hear you have written a novel. We give credence an open mind. Well, untruer words were never written.
Later in the archive interview, Miles Dungan raises a controversial question with Edna O'Brien. Her marriage to Ernest Gebler and his influence on her career. She married him before publishing The Country Girls.
You mentioned your former husband, Ernest Gebler, the late Ernest Gebler. He famously claimed to have had a huge part in the writing of The Country Girls. He said he claimed to have sat up each night, I quote, rewriting your schoolgirl tosh. It must have been fairly painful to read that. Just for the record, did he play any significant part in the writing of your first novel?
No. You see, and again, I could easily say no, and you could say, someone could say, oh, she's being defensive, but I'll tell you why he didn't or how he couldn't. He knows nothing about that world. He knows nothing about convents or County Clare. Or it would be, first, that's the first part of the logic. The second is, I wrote a lot of other books after that. How did I manage to do them?
And that's all for Playback this week. Thank you for listening. Sinead will be back next Saturday with Playback's Best of the Year. In the meantime, have a very happy Christmas.